Hello, I'm Rob Sachetto. This is number 0171, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And here it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0171. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actress Tippi Hedren, best known for her role in The Birds, talks about working with Alfred Hitchcock and having to deal with his unwanted advances.
There was nothing I could do. You know, I'm not the only one this happened to. Two of the Hitchcock women became pregnant to get out of their contracts. But this is a story that I feel that should be told for women who, whatever phase of life they're in, that it's important that they are able to say, no, I will not acquiesce to anything that I am not interested in or that offends me.
Mark Abrams is back on the program to talk about this year's Ig Nobel Prizes, including this year's award for medicine.
Yes, it went to two French doctors who published a report giving advice to doctors anywhere who perform colonoscopies. The advice is how to do a colonoscopy in a way that minimizes the chance that your patient will explode.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0171, was Rob Sachetto, who is a zombie artist. No, he's not a zombie, but he does draw them quite well. You can check out his website at zombieportraits.com. And thank you very much, Rob, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that you can also hear on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, we start off with a story that takes us all the way to Sweden. A Swedish woman accused of using human bones as sex toys, yes, told authorities she collected the remains because she is interested in history. Prosecutors say the 37-year-old woman, who was arrested in September and charged last week in Gothenburg District Court with violating the peace of the dead, was in possession of a CD labeled My Necrophilia and My First Experience when she was arrested. Apparently she likes really older men. The prosecutor in the case said authorities do not know how the woman obtained the bones, but an initial homicide investigation was later dropped. The woman, who pleaded not guilty, said she has done nothing illegal. She faces fines and as much as 2 years in prison if convicted. Wow. You know, this is a family show, so go ahead and write your own punchline. All the ones I can think of, I really can't say now. In England, a British man admitted to accidentally handing out bags of cocaine to trick-or-treaters who turned out to be the children of a police officer. Oldham Magistrates Court heard Donald Green, age 23, accidentally drop the bags of cocaine into the candy sacks of three children ages 8, 6, and 5 instead of the candy bags in his pocket. Police Constable Simon Fowell, the children's father, soon recognized the strange packages in his children's bags, and Green was arrested on a charge of possessing a Class A drug. Green pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 12 months of probation, as well as 130 hours of community work and court costs totaling $230. Gee, how embarrassing for Donald was that faux pas, huh? I mean, could you imagine if he actually went home and tried to snort candy? Two inmates at the Hilland Mountain Correctional Center, which is a woman's prison in Eagle River, Alaska, reported to guards that a man had stopped his pickup truck outside the perimeter fence and thrown a tennis ball inside. The male looked visibly upset when the package didn't make it over both fences. A witness said guards were able to find it. It contained 13 doses of heroin, syringes, and chewing tobacco. I'm guessing he throws like a girl. Investigators allegedly have recordings of phone calls between Kaylee Jake Gibbons, age 34, and his wife, Rebecca Pendleton, age 35, where she asked him to bring her contraband. Both had been arrested in a theft case, but Gibbons bailed out, leaving Pendleton behind. Gibbons was arrested and charged with first and second degree promoting contraband, second and fourth degree misconduct involving a controlled substance, trespassing, and violating conditions of his earlier release from jail. By the time he was jailed, Pendleton had been released and police are looking for her again. I'm guessing she'll probably be easy to find. Just keep an eye out for that pickup truck outside the men's jail this time. I'm sure that's where you'll find her. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a New York doctor is marketing Botox at card games or at card players to help them maintain their poker face. Dr. Jack Birdie has introduced Poker Talks, a program of Botox and facial fillers to enhance a player's ability to hide their emotions. He first consults with poker players on their tells, that's the unconscious signs or signals they give off on whether they have a good or bad hand. Some people might get a card they like or don't like and raise their eyebrows, Dr. Birdie told the Huffington Post. If that's the common reaction, we can put Botox in certain areas to minimize them. We can also put Botox in areas to make it look like the player has a tell they really don't have. Dr. Birdie is hoping the treatment will prove a surefire bet, although he is still waiting for his first customer 1 week after launch. Now, however, poker player Josh Hale, who has competed at the World Poker Tour, thinks the idea is 10 or maybe 15 years too late. The game has moved on from bluffs and is more analytical these days, he said. Players might like to look at physical tells, but they are relying more on betting patterns and on bet sizing. Yeah, plus, wouldn't it just freak you out if you were playing against someone who always looked perpetually surprised? It'd be like sitting next to Joan Crawford all day. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Screen legend Tippi Hedren is best known for her roles in a couple of classic Hitchcock films. The Golden Globe-winning actress is also known for her love of big cats and is the founder of the Roar Foundation and the Shambhala Preserve. And Tippi joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Tippi.
Hello. Good evening.
Hi. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. I want to talk about your work with Hitchcock in a bit because that's making news these days, but first, I want to talk a little bit about something that's near and dear to your heart, and I understand that you, along with a congressman, have introduced a bipartisan bill called Big Cats and Public Safety Protection Act?
Yes, we have.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that came out of my 40 years of rescuing big cats that have been born in captivity to be sold as a pet or for financial gain. And this happened a whole lot of years ago when I did two films in Africa. And during that, 1969 and 1970, and during those years, environmentalists all over the world were saying if we, people of the world, didn't do something right then to stop the encroaching civilization and spore hunting and bird just killing wild animals, by the year 2000, they would be gone. And so my then husband and I decided to do a film. He was a producer, and we decided to do a film about animals in the wild and the problems they have out there. And on the Goran Goes a Game Preserve, we went on a photo safari. And on the Goran Goes a Game Preserve, there was a house that had been abandoned by a game warden because it flooded during the rainy seasons. He moved out, and a pride of lion moved into this house. It was the most amazing sight ever. It was a double-story house. The lions were sitting in the windows. They were looking like great portraits. They were going in and out the doors. They were napping on the verandas. The cubs were playing out in front. I mean, it was an amazing sight. And We saw a perfect movie set, animals of which most people are enchanted with, and or scared to death of, which is smart. And so we decided to do, do this film using these great, wonderful lions. And, you couldn't tell how many there were. We kind of estimated there must have been 25 to 30 lions of all sizes living in this house. And that's the way the script was written. We were going to, when we got back to the coast in California, we talked to different trainers of these animals, and they all came back laughing at us and saying, this movie can't be done. And we said, why not? And they said, because the instinctual dictates to fight. I don't want my cat hurt. I don't want to be hurt. Get your own animals to do the movie. Well, that's a romantic notion. But that is what we did. And so in 1972, we started, the first one was a rescue. And from then on, I have been rescuing big cats of all sizes. And, when we were filming our the movie Roar, I really started wondering, why aren't there laws? Because we were accepting animals sometimes 10 and 12 at a time, lions, tigers, whatever. And I was thinking, why aren't there laws prohibiting the breeding of these animals to be sold as pets? So, long story short, that is what I'm doing now. I started in the year 2000, and I was successful in getting a bill passed, a federal bill, and that was just to stop the interstate traffic. It was titled the Captive Wildlife Safety Act. I brought it to my own Congressman, Buck McKeon, and he introduced it. I testified for it, and what I did was I listed about 18 accidents out of the hundreds that had happened by these animals, lions and tigers, and the bill passed unanimously in the House and Senate, and President Bush signed it on December 19th of 2003. So now the bill that I'm working on is Big Cats Public Safety Protection Act, and that's going to stop the breeding of these big cats to be sold as pets or for financial gain.
Now, people often think that when it comes to exotic animals like this, that this is a problem that takes place someplace else. Like, I would assume a lot of people would be surprised that this is a problem within the United States.
Oh, it's huge. In fact, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, it's on a par with illegal drugs. It's gigantic. In fact, when things of this nature. And it's nasty money, and it becomes dangerous. With the Captive Wildlife Safety Act, my life was threatened, as well as they were going to bring illnesses and diseases into the Shambhala Preserve to harm, the wrecked cats that we had rescued. They may be very tough, but they're not very smart. They left the threat on my answering machine. And so I was able to call authorities and say, would you come over and listen to this? I said, I don't run scared, but I don't like this. And they came over and listened to it, and I was under house arrest, or you might call it. I mean, I couldn't leave the preserve. Unless I rented a car, had somebody with me to watch to make sure we weren't followed. I had to check the car before we got back into it to make sure the bombs were not underneath it. They had the sheriff come to go through everybody's bags before they came into the preserve to make sure they weren't bringing in anything that could hurt me or the animals. Several weeks later, they found that the man was from out of the state of California. The FBI came in, and they got him. He was an animal dealer, New Jersey, and I don't know what happened to him. They never tell you what happens, but Anyway, this is a huge, huge business, and most people are not aware of it, which is unfortunate. And it is the animals who suffer more than anything, and it really has to be stopped. And, you know, the word conservation comes in, you know, that beautiful word, oh, we're going to conserve the animals. Well, I say, for what? For what? The animals cannot be returned to the wild for many reasons. First of all, they haven't had a mother to teach them how to live in the wild. They, if they were to be returned to the wild, if they came up to a human, which they would do, they would be killed because they would, you know, they wouldn't know whether this animal was coming to say, hi, how are you, or, boy, I'm going to get you. You know, so there's nothing good about this breeding these animals in captivity. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. There is not one thing we can give a wild animal in captivity that they need.
Now, you have the Shambhala Preserve, as I mentioned earlier. How long have you had it now, and how many animals, how many cats are at the preserve?
Let's see. Well, I formed the Rohr Foundation in 1983 after we had completed our movie and distributed it all over the world. And but by the year, within 3 years, all of those monies were gone. So I formed the Rohr Foundation so that we could accept donations in order to keep the Shambhala Preserve here, you know, to be able to continue rescuing these big cats. And what was the other part of the question?
And how many cats do you have at Shambhala right now?
Well, we have varying amounts of animals. They live here for the rest of their lives. At one point, we had, in the 80s, we had 150 big cats here. Now we have 48, and we need to raise a whole lot of money to refurbish some of the compounds, because they need to be done. And, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately, I should say, they are so large that the compounds with a 9-gauge chain link and concreted 2 feet into the ground and the overhang at the top of the fencing, these habitats cost $100,000.
Wow. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is shambhala.org, correct?
Yes. And you can hear, you can read the stories about the different animals and what they went through before they got here, and the legislation that I'm working on, and, you know, the programs that we have here. And it's an amazing thing that we've been doing here since, for 40 years, but especially since 1983.
It's fascinating stuff indeed. Fascinating stuff indeed. I want to get a chance to talk a little bit about your acting career and your work with Alfred Hitchcock, which is getting a lot of coverage and notoriety at this time. But I have to take a quick break, so we'll continue talking when we return, okay?
Oh, perfect.
So we'll continue our chat with Tippi Hedren and delve into her work with Alfred Hitchcock in just a moment. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey. Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we are continuing our chat with Hollywood screen legend Tippi Hedren here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A show also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And Tippi, of late, there's been a lot of talk about Alfred Hitchcock. There is a new theatrical release that's just come out. And there is also the HBO film called The Girl, which tells the story of your experience, Tippi, with the legendary director. And I want to ask you about working with Hitchcock, because now the stories are coming out about the problems you had with Hitch, but we really didn't hear a lot about that back in the day, did we?
No, we didn't. Yeah, because of the fact that it was the studio era, and there was nothing I could do. No matter who I talked to, they said there's, you know, they just said there was nothing they could do. And this happened, you know, I'm not the only one this happened to. And two of the Hitchcock women became pregnant to get out of their contracts. You know, so, but this is a story that I feel that should be told. And for women who, whatever phase of life they're in, whatever vocation or career they decide to embark upon, that it's important that they are able to say, no, I will not acquiesce to anything that I am not interested in or that offends me. And so I hope that gets across.
Did you have any connection in working on the film or working with the producers of HBO's movie The Girl?
Yes, I did. Yes, I worked with the producers and with the writer. So it is very factual, and the writer, Gwyneth Hughes, came out to the Preserve, and we talked for, you know, several hours about this, about the film and the importance of it, and the, you know, the situations that had occurred and how difficult it was, and and then when she went back to England to write, she contacted me often about the screenplay.
Have you seen the finished product? I happened to see the girl just the other day, as a matter of fact. Have you seen the finished product?
Yes, I have. I've seen it twice.
Was it difficult at all for you to watch it?
Yeah, it's very difficult for me to watch, and I don't know. I don't know when I'll be, you know, want to see it again, because it is an unhappy, rather drastic time in my life. And, you know, the thing that I keep thinking, and I mentioned this to Hitchcock at one point, I said, why are you doing this? Why are you ruining this incredible working relationship that we had, because I really loved working with him. He was brilliant. He was brilliant as a director. He was brilliant as my drama coach. And then to have this horrible burden put upon me that was unbearable, was not feasible in my life.
As the movie depicts, as the TV movie predicts on HBO, his wife Alma knew what was going on. Was she really complicit in all of this?
Well, apparently she was. I think their relationship was an enigma to all of Hollywood. I don't think anybody understood it. I certainly didn't. Nobody did. You know, at one point, she said to me, "I'm so sorry you have to go through this." And I just looked at her and I said, "But Alma, you could stop it." And she, her eyes sort of glazed over, and she turned and walked away.
You had a difficult time working with Hitchcock, but as you mentioned, he was a great director. He was a great drama coach for you. After all the problems you had with him, you severed ties with him after doing Marnie.
Yes.
Yet you went to his funeral.
Well, you know, Sammy, I've been able to totally separate the fact that he was an absolutely brilliant entity in the film industry. Absolutely brilliant. And he will always and should be always remembered as being such. So I have been able to separate the genius and unfortunately the dark side of the man who created the genius.
Did you have any say in the actress who played you?
I did. They discussed different actresses with me, and when they talked about Sienna Miller, I was thrilled. Absolutely thrilled.
And did she follow you around or talk to you or watch your mannerisms or do anything to get into the mindset of playing Tippi Hedren?
Well, the only thing, she lives in England. And I live in, you know, on the Shambhala Preserve in Southern California. So that wasn't possible. But we did meet here. She was in L.A. and was able to come and to the Shambhala Preserve to talk to me. And we had several hours in which I could talk to her about my upbringing, about my feelings, about my strengths, from where they came. And she listened very carefully. She called me from the set every now and then to talk to me and discuss different scenes, which I appreciated a great deal.
One of the things I found rather chilling in watching the girl was the attic scene. I never realized what you went through to make that movie in The Birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and the fact that he lied to me at the very, very beginning because when I read the script and we got to the end of the film, first of all, I said, why would she go up those stairs all by herself? And you know, knowing what has happened to the children, to the people in the city, in the little town of Bodega, and the horrors of what had happened, I said, why would she go up there all by herself? And he said, like he had never even thought of that question. He said, because I tell you to. Oh, okay, fine. And then I said, and how would we be doing that scene where I go open the door and the birds come flying at me? And he said, oh, well, we'll use the mechanical birds like we do when the children are being filmed. So I thought, that's fine. And, you know, nobody told me. Everybody lied to me. The morning that we were supposed to begin the scene, I was in my dressing room on the set, and Jim Brown, the assistant director, first AD, came in, and he couldn't look at me. He looked at the floor, at the walls, and the ceiling, and I said, Jim, what's the matter with you? And he said, the mechanical birds don't work. We have to use real ones. And out the door he sailed. Well, I picked my jaw up from the floor, and I went out to the set. And there had been no intentions of using mechanical birds. There wasn't a mechanical bird in sight. However, there were four crates, cartons of raven and gull and a few pigeons thrown in a cage around the set, the door that I opened, and there were four bird trainers who had gauntlets up to their shoulders, and they hurled birds at me for a week. So it was a week of a nightmare, and by Friday, they had me on the floor, and they had tied the birds to me. And one of them jumped from my shoulder to my, and just really so narrowly missed my eye that I just got all of the birds off me, and I just sat in the middle of the set and just burst into tears of sheer exhaustion.
Wow. Now, your daughter, Melanie Griffith, is a fine actress in her own right.
Indeed.
What was it like for you, with all that you went through in your career and all the problems and trials and tribulations you had, what was it like for you when your daughter said, you know, Ma, I think I want to do what you do?
Well, you know, my daughter didn't know what I went through because she was so little, and I never talked about it for 20 years. Because I was afraid if I talked about it that it would get out in, you know, the press, and it would be taken the wrong way, and so Melanie didn't know anything about this whole situation. She was little, you know, she was a little girl when I went through all of this with the Hitchcock years. I never told my parents about it. They would have been heartbroken to think that I had to go through all of this. And so by the time she decided to go into film, I was surprised because I, you know, all she knew was that it was horrible hours and you know, it's not all red carpets and Klieg lights and excitement and glamour. It's hard work, terrible hours, responsibility of being the lead in a motion picture, and it's an enormous responsibility, and you know, when she decided to do it, you don't realize how whether somebody is going to be a success or not until they've done several things or whatever. And with my daughter, it turned out to be a really fabulous career for her.
Hmm. Well, you certainly kept your daughter sheltered from the early situations you dealt with earlier in your career.
Yeah.
And I got to say, you know, to your credit, when people see you on the screen, you made it look easy. No one knew what was going on. At least the fans didn't.
When the only thing that was important to me when I was going through all of that with Hitchcock was my job, and I was the responsibility of carrying two motion pictures in the leading roles, you know, the female leading role, was so huge, and that had more of my attention than anything. And I was going to make them that those roles as good as I possibly could.
And that indeed you did. Tippi, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us. It's always a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you, and I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed talking with us as well.
Well, I did, and I hope all of your audience will look up the Shambhala Preserve at Shambhala, shambhala.org for organization.
I'm sure they will. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Legendary film star and Golden Globe winning actress Tippi Hedren. As you heard her mention, you can go to her website at shambhala.org for information on the work she does with animals at her preserve. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0171, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Even though there's still 1 month left in 2012, I think I've just read the most ridiculous lawsuit of the year. A Florida man is suing the Buffalo Bills for sending him three too many text messages. Here's the story. In late September, this so-called fan went to the team's website and signed up to receive news about the team through text messages to his phone. The team said it would send up to 5 messages per week, but after the man received 6 messages 1 week and 7 another, he filed a class action lawsuit against the team. Now he's demanding thousands of dollars for those 3 extra text messages. Let's be fair. I know text messages can sometimes cost the person who gets them, but suing over this is absurd. My main problem after reading the lawsuit is that there's not a single mention of the man ever trying to resolve this issue out of court. That type of sue first, ask questions later approach ends up costing all of us. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the Ig Nobel Awards, and of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. But first, more Stuff File news for you here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. American Family Insurance gave Andy Woodward, age 36, trouble over his homeowner's policy after they discovered he had a dog, a Belgian Malinois named Diesel. It's a big issue. Dog bites or dog attacks are the largest single cause of homeowners' claims since the 1990s, said company spokesperson Steve Whitmer. He adds the company's underwriting guidelines restrict certain breeds of dog. While Diesel isn't one of the prohibited breeds, he is also prohibited because he's trained as a guard dog or, in reality, as a canine officer. You see, the pooch is Woodward's partner and fellow deputy for the Douglas County, Nebraska Sheriff's Office. Now, Diesel is also fully insured by the county. He's my dog, Woodward said. He has to go home with me, and indeed, the county requires it. When Woodward explained that, the company said it would send him a letter for the county to sign. Instead, they sent him a cancellation notice. Wow. Nice going, guys. Isn't there some kind of extra risk to the company from keeping their own heads that far up their own butts? That's what I want to know. On to Sarasota, Florida. Sarasota, Florida was once named the meanest city in the nation by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty and the National Coalition for the Homeless. But eventually that designation was forgotten. Darren Kersey, age 28, is homeless and stopped at a picnic shelter in a public park in Sarasota to recharge his cell phone. He was promptly arrested. The charge, theft of city utilities, will not be tolerated during this bad economy, said Sergeant Anthony Fangione, as he wrote it up in his report, or, in more legal terms, misdemeanor theft. Circuit County Judge Charles Williams begged to differ. He threw the case out, but not until Kersey had spent a night in jail because he couldn't afford the $500 bail. Meanwhile, the city, by the way, provides free power to charge electric vehicles for anyone wealthy enough to have one. So currently, I guess, there are two different classes when it comes to people who can get electricity. The daily problems of first world living. Yeah. And Söderhamn, Sweden, has a soaring unemployment problem, especially among youth age 18 to 28. We had an unemployment rate of over 25%, so we had to find solutions, said Magnus Nilsson, who is charged with figuring out that solution. So far, about 100 people have signed up for the town's Job Journey program. They're being paid to move to Norway to find work there. Yeah, so the best way to solve the problem of unemployment in Sweden is to have people move to Norway. I guess the next problem Nilsson will have to tackle is the town's dwindling tax base. Anyway, Deborah Fashikin is 33, and she told police she was pumping gas at Seat Pleasant, Maryland, when someone jumped into her car and drove away. The real problem, her three children, age 1, 4, and 5, were inside. Prince George's County Police issued an Amber Alert and called in every detective available, suspending what they call proactive activities, such as surveillance, to focus on the search. Police were able to locate the stolen car, but the children weren't inside. Fashikin later allegedly confessed that she had made up the part about her children because she wanted an enhanced police response to finding her stolen car. Yeah, that's what police spokeswoman Julie Parker said. Fashikin was charged with making a false statement and was held on $5,000 bond. This response cost tens of thousands of dollars and pulled resources that otherwise would have been spent serving the citizens of Prince George's County, Parker said. We took this seriously. We had to. Now, I want to know which is worse, the fact that this woman lied about her children, or the fact that that's the only way it seems they would take an auto theft seriously. Actually, there's not even a debate here. Deborah simply just isn't the mother of the year. Let's leave it at that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Michael Carrier, age 45, was arrested for soliciting prostitution in New Milford, Connecticut in August, not resulting from a police sting, which is the usual way of how arrests for that crime are made. In Carrier's case, he was disturbing other customers at a Friendly's restaurant because, being hard of hearing, he was shouting to the prostitute the terms of their prospective business arrangement. Yes. Anybody see the irony of someone looking for a prostitute at a place called Friendly's? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's an annual event on the program going back to the old radio show. It's our chat with Mark Abrams. He's here every year. He's with the Annals of Improbable Research, and they annually have the Ig Nobel Awards. And not only that, but this year, they're branching out with a book and television. So, who are the big winners this year? Time to find out. Mark is on with us via Skype-to-Skype communication. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Peter.
So, who are the big winners this year? What's improbable?
Oh, no, you know the ritual. You have to ask me about each winner individually.
Oh, dear.
This is in our unstated contract.
I know there's always a test. There's always a test. I understand, for instance, you've discovered the physics of ponytails.
We discovered the people who discovered the physics of ponytails. We gave the Ig Nobel Physics Prize this year to four scientists. Some are in England, some in the U.S. One group of them figured out why it is that ponytails are shaped the way they are. Ponytails always have a certain kind of shape, and there are certain shapes you never ever will see a ponytail take because the physics of the universe doesn't allow it. And the other group figured out why it is when somebody with a ponytail is walking that the ponytail sways in the particular way that it does.
I'm guessing the person who studied that watched a lot of the Brady Bunch.
No, in fact, he's much older than the group that would typically have watched the Brady Bunch. He is a professor, and he had noticed on campus, often he'd be walking from one building to another, he'd be behind somebody with a ponytail, and he'd notice that the person is kind of bouncing up and down, but the ponytail usually bounces side to side. Why is that? That's what started him on his scientific journey.
You know, there are people who think that this might be a trivial situation, but this is the kind of thing that, quite frankly, I think most of us find fascinating. Because we all have these little questions in our lives about the way things work or why something is the way it is, but we don't have the scientific background to actually study it.
Yeah, or the inclination. Things like this physics of ponytails thing, the same kinds of motions and shapes happen in lots of other places, including things like buildings and machines, and also these things pretty quickly sometimes have even practical implications, although with the Ig Nobels sometimes they don't too.
Now this year's Ig Nobel Peace Prize I think is really inventive. Turning old ammunition into diamonds?
This is a company in Russia. They are doing exactly that. They buy lots of old Russian ammunition. They explode it in a particular way, and that turns it, at least part of it, into little microscopic diamonds.
Wow. Now, your prizes in the Ig Nobel Prizes mirror what's in the Nobel Prizes, but there are some that are not. Like, I don't recall there's an acoustic prize for the Nobels, are there?
I don't recall ever hearing of one either.
Okay.
Right, yeah. We give 10 prizes. The Nobel people give, I think, 6 prizes every year. And our categories somewhat stay the same year to year, but we will sometimes have to invent a category if there's something that just doesn't fit. Remember, I think we've talked about it before, the one that was the most difficult that comes to mind was about 13 years ago, we gave a prize to Troy Hurtubise, the Pride of North Bay, Ontario. Troy's the guy who had spent years building and personally testing that suit of armor to protect him against grizzly bears.
Right.
And it took us a long time to figure out what category do you give this a prize in, building suits of armor to protect you against grizzly bears. We finally decided, oh, okay, he will win the prize in the field of safety engineering.
Love it. Love it. Now, very similar to winning a prize for ponytails, the Fluid Dynamics Prize also went to people who studied the dynamics of liquid sloshing.
That's right. What happens specifically when you hold a cup of coffee in your hands and start to walk? For almost everybody, that's dangerous. It's very hard not to spill the coffee. What these physics professors figured out is it's not entirely your fault. You know, you might think that you're clumsy, or you might even be clumsy, I don't know. You know, you and I communicate just by radio or by telephone. But for anybody, the physics of it make it a very difficult thing. It's very, very tough to carry a cup of liquid in your hand and not spill it.
And somebody who has a PhD in this, I would assume, is a lifetime waitress.
That's better than a PhD.
Okay.
One of the things I've learned just because of this and looking into it is that a lot of waiters have a technique, so they won't spill things as much. They've discovered that if you let yourself get into a rhythm while you're walking, carrying something like that, you're likely to spill. So they will very carefully not allow themselves to get into a rhythm when they're walking.
Hmm. Now, one of the things I find interesting is the prize that deals with anatomy, and I'll let you explain that one because it involves chimpanzees.
That's why you're allowing me to explain it. Okay. This is a couple of people who have spent their lifetimes studying all sorts of things about chimpanzees and other animals vaguely akin to that. They did some experiments, and they discovered that chimpanzees are able to recognize photographs of the butts, the rear ends of other chimpanzees. And they, just by looking at those photos of the rear ends of other chimpanzees, they can identify them. This is assuming that these are photos of chimps that they know. They can't do it with strangers, of course.
I'm just wondering if that's much different than humans, but I digress.
It's a question. It possibly is even a good question, but it's certainly a question. And if anyone listening today carries out a test carefully, we'd love to hear what you find.
Now, over the years, we've talked to you about this, and over the years, more and more of the people who are winners of the Ig Nobels are showing up, more so than when you first started. This year, of the many people who were nominated and won, how many attended the event?
I believe we give 10 prizes, and I think it was 9 of them showed up.
Wow. Excellent. So it's become very prestigious to win an Ig Nobel Prize.
I'm not sure prestigious is exactly the word, but we do, in almost every case, give people very quietly the chance to turn it down if they want to. But almost everyone decides to accept. The one who didn't come this year, by the way, was the winner of the Literature Prize. We gave the Ig Nobel Literature Prize this year to a large U.S. government agency because they published a report about reports about reports. And in that report about reports about reports, they end up with a recommendation that somebody do a new report about the report about reports about reports.
Wow.
And in trying to find somebody at that agency who we could invite, we just couldn't. We got lost in a maze. We just couldn't track down anybody who would talk to us.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you're branching out with a book and also television. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the book has just come out. It's called This Is Improbable, and it's about a lot of the kinds of research that we're talking about here. A few of the things in there have won Ig Nobel Prizes, but there are lots and lots of others. A lot of the book comes from the newspaper column that I've been doing for about 10 years, and I went back and looked at a lot of the things I'd written about, and looked up some of the people again to see, hey, what have they done since I wrote about them? And it turned out a lot of them had kept on going, other unusual things.
Would it be fair to say that even though people take this, you know, what they do as far as a discipline very seriously, that they do have a little bit of a sense of humor about themselves?
People are people. A lot of the things I write about are funny to anybody who on the outside sees them or hears about them, but to the people who do them are just ordinary. It's what they do every day. To some of them, they have enough contact with other people that they realize, yeah, this looks pretty funny to somebody. It would look funny to me too. But I think we've talked about this quite a bit in the past, but whatever you do, I mean whatever you do, no matter who you are, a lot of what you're doing is going to look pretty funny to somebody who doesn't do it. And I would bet you anything that everybody, there are lots of stuff you do during the day, but lots of little things you do every day that you never put into words because you would sound like an insane person if you mentioned it to anybody.
Speaking of which, I want to talk about, we have time for one more item. I want to talk about the prize for medicine this year. It involves colonoscopies.
Yes, it went to two French doctors who published a report giving advice to doctors anywhere who perform colonoscopies. The advice is how to do it, how to do a colonoscopy in a way that minimizes the chance that your patient will explode.
Have there been situations where people have exploded?
Why, yes, there have. In the days when colonoscopies were becoming a fairly common routine, and they're now very common, but in those days, of course, people hadn't done it all that often, and if it's not done properly, it can be dangerous. What makes it dangerous is inside the digestive system, there are a lot of gases. Methane is the main one, but gases that could be used, if you wanted to, as fuel for vehicles, things that will explode if you bring a spark near them or heat. And the way that the colonoscopies work is that the doctor will put a tube into the patient and often have something, a source of light in there that would sometimes give off heat or a spark. And there were explosions. There were deaths. And after a while, they figured out how to do this, so it's pretty safe. But now, every once in a while, it still happens. And it's very embarrassing to the doctors to even mention this subject.
I would think so. But it's always a pleasure to, that's a weird note to end on, but it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Finish that sentence, please, Peter.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show to talk about the annual event, the Annals of Improbable Research, the Ig Nobel Prize. Thank you very much, Mark, for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you.
Mark Abrams from the Annals of Improbable Research. They're the folks who put out the annual Ig Nobel Awards. You can find out more information by going to their website at www.improbable.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0171, and you'll find the links. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order their new book, This is Improbable, Cheese String Theory, Magnetic Chickens, and Other WTF Research. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Mississippi man who went to the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office in Slidell, Louisiana, asking for a copy of a police report, was arrested after being caught on surveillance video detaching pens from metal chains and putting them into his pocket. 33-year-old Edward Allen Lucas from Picayune, Mississippi, was booked on one count of misdemeanor theft. Captain George Bonnet says clerks at the office said Lucas was acting suspiciously, walking up and down in front of the area in front of the records division counter, while they were pulling the file he requested. After he left the building, he says the clerks noticed three pens were missing. Bonnet says detectives questioned Lucas and he admitted to stealing the pens. Now why, oh why, would someone walk into a police station looking suspicious already and then steal not one, not two, but three pens that are chained to the counter again, I mention, in a police station? One reason, and one reason only, He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0171. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's number 0171. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.